Good morning. Just before 6 o'clock on Monday evening, Drive Time's Mary Wilson brought us this.
Before I go to weather, the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, is holding his daily briefing about COVID-19 as we speak. In the last few minutes, he had this to say.
In the last 24 hours, we didn't have any deaths notified to us. In fact, two were denotified, bringing the total now to 1,606.
And that is news the country has waited to hear. For the first time in months, the Department of Health not notified of any new deaths of people with COVID-19. Let's check on the weather now with Joan
Blackburn. It's sunny and hopefully getting sunnier. On Tuesday, Catherine Motherway, President of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland, spoke to Samantha Labrerie on Morning Ireland.
How significant a development is it that there was no new death reported last night?
Well, obviously, last night that was a good milestone. We had it a constant, in fact, I think there'd only been one day prior to the start of the pandemic since the first death that we'd had no deaths. So it is to be welcomed that no lives were lost in the preceding 24 hours. We have still got a long way to go. And obviously, we continue to live with the virus, as the CMO said last night, and we continue to try and emerge from our houses and back into our lives, trying to live in a slightly different way and taking more care, ensuring that we continue to observe the physical distancing, the cough etiquette, the hand hygiene, and essentially following the public guidance as we emerge. And they will continue, I think, to observe the number of cases, in particular the number of hospital admissions and the number of intensive care admissions, as those restrictions lift. And one wouldn't expect, given the incubation period of the virus, to see any difference until about 2, maybe 3 weeks from whatever changes are made, which I think is why the pace of change seems so slow to people who are keen to get out again. But it'll take 2 weeks for the virus to infect people. They'll take another week to get sick and potentially another few days to need to go to hospital. So it's going to take us time to see which restrictions, when they're lifted, will make a difference and which don't, and how we can actually manage to live with this virus.
So good news, but let's not lose the run of ourselves. But as restrictions ease and loosen, what about, as Brainy Spice Mary Wilson puts it,
the meter argument, when two becomes one?
Yes, for it is stamped on the ground all over the country. We need to stay 2 metres apart. But maybe we can social distance and be safe at 1 metre. Well, the WHO Special Envoy on COVID-19, David Nabarro, spoke to Sarah McInerney on Monday.
When a person coughs, the droplets that are associated with the cough come out of that person's mouth. Most of them don't travel further than 1 metre. Very, very few of them travel further than 2 metres. So over the years, the World Health Organization and others have said the best distance to keep away from people if you want to avoid inhaling a droplet from somebody's cough is 2 metres. That basically keeps you safe 99% of the time. But you can greatly reduce risk even at 1 metre, because around 70% of the droplets will stick within 1 metre. So that's why what we always have to do is to offer advice that talks about risk. And we think that if you really want to reduce the risk of picking up the virus from somebody who's infected, please stay at least 2 metres away from other people. But if you're in difficulty and you have to get close, for example, you're providing care, or you are in a factory where 2 metres distance just doesn't work, you can still greatly reduce risk by being 1 metre away. And every time there is a decision made by a government or by a supervisor in a factory, it's always a case of weighing up the balance of risks. Can we keep the business going with 2 metres physical distancing, or is that going too far? And should we reduce it to a slightly lower level? Answer: if you get closer, then the risk slightly increases.
And David Nabarro talked about the risk factors in closed spaces, cold versus hot weather, and then the nature of your cough or sneeze.
There are some people who cough in a really incredible, explosive way.
For example?
And they seem to be able to project the virus much further than people who cough in a softer way.
Bambi cough.
Or don't have very explosive coughing.
WHO envoy Dr. David Nabarro with Sarah McInerney. Sound effects all our own. And while we might look to countries like Denmark, as Professor Philip Nolan, chair of NEPHID, Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group, said on Morning Ireland yesterday, we're not Denmark.
Different countries have different cultures and different social structures. For instance, classrooms and school structures vary quite widely across Europe. So first of all, we need time. And secondly, we need to be careful of our interpretation of the results from other countries, because what happens in one context may emerge somewhat differently in another context.
And on that same programme, Rachel English spoke to Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue.
There have been concerted calls this week for the reduction of the 2 metre distancing rule. Your own cabinet colleague, Michael Ring, thinks it should be reduced. What's your view?
I'm going to be very much guided by the public health guidance in this area, as indeed all my cabinet colleagues are. I just had to listen to Professor Philip Nolan, been interviewed before I came on, to be reminded of the kind of expertise and insight that Philip and his colleagues have on this and many other matters. We will look at the evidence in this, and I will be guided, excuse me, Rachel, by that evidence and by the success that we have in reopening our economy while hopefully containing this disease.
Right. Does that mean then that for as long as Tony Houlihan says 2 metres, you're sticking with 2 metres?
Well, I'll take his advice and input in the matter very carefully, and then I'll seek to balance that against all of the other things that I'm directly responsible for as Minister for Finance.
What does that mean?
Well, Philip, in the interview that he gave a few moments ago, for example, made the point that getting people back to work, it's not only vital for our economy. He talked about the, you know, many of the different costs and issues that we have at the moment in our economy. I'm directly responsible for all of that. But what I want to do is that if we make further decisions to reopen our economy, that we do that in a way that does not undermine the success that we have had in containing this disease.
Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue. And of course, this week also saw the COVID-19 payment making the news. On Thursday, Supermax Pat McDonough talked about winning the lotto, COVID style.
You were quoted during the week saying that you cannot recruit some staff because the €350 was discouraging people to take up part-time work. Is that an experience that you've had firsthand?
Well, first of all, let me clarify this, whether I was misinterpreted or misquoted, either intentionally or otherwise. I did welcome the COVID-19 payment, which was introduced at the initial stages of the pandemic, and I complimented the government for doing it. But going into the next phase, as I said, it needed to be reviewed, and some people should get more and others less. And I'll give you an example of that, where we have a mother and son working for us. He's a student. He worked 8 hours a week, and he got somewhere between probably 80 and 100 euros. She was full-time, and she had to look after her elderly parents, and rightly so. And both qualified for the 350 COVID payment. Now, I felt, and I do feel, that the mother would be entitled to get a bit more than the son, who was, as I say, only worked one shift a week, but he got equally €350. Now, there's no incentive for him to come back to work because he's on a winner. He's won the lotto. And therefore, it's difficult to convince him to come back to work because, as well as that, even from the employer's point of view, he doesn't qualify. If he does more, in other words, than one shift, the employer doesn't qualify for the wage subsidy for him. So therefore, it's a lose situation in both cases because he's on 350 a week. Why would he bother coming back to work when he can sit at home and get 350 into his account every week?
Yeah, I don't know what I call it, winning the lotto, Pat, €350 a week.
Well, if you multiply it for 10, 12 weeks, maybe it's the GAA lotto. It's 3,500 versus 1,000 if he were working.
He works out at less than the minimum wage if you're working it out over a year.
Yeah, but he's a student. He was only working one shift a week.
So what then does he think should happen?
In that situation, I think the mother could be well entitled. She has two kids. She's minding her elderly parents. and obviously she can't come back to work, I think she should be entitled to get probably 450 or 500. And on the other hand, I think the young lad should be getting no more than what he was making when he was a part-time employee, and that would incentivize him to come back to work.
And then the conversation moved on to more general issues about staffing and conditions.
One of the comments made on social media, maybe you could clarify it or not, is that you charge your staff or you dock your staff 20 cent an hour off their wages for food. Is that right?
We up to 160, and we give them a meal, and we give them also a break of coffee or whatever else for that.
If they don't take the meal, do they still get 20 cent an hour docked off their wages?
That's what's applied across the board. Whether they take it or whether they don't is up to themselves.
And what about €1.25 that staff have to pay for their uniform a week?
That's no longer in vogue.
Do you think things like that, Pat, where you're running restaurants, that you couldn't give your staff maybe a bag of chips for free? Do you think things like that aren't an incentive to come back to work when you're taking 20 cent off somebody who's earning the minimum wage
hour? I don't think that's the point at all, actually, Sarah. The point is that they get a meal worth €10. Now, if we charge 160 or whatever for the meal, then I think the value of it is much greater than, and they can get a coffee or a break whenever they want. That isn't the issue that's there. That hasn't been an issue up to now. I think the staff are quite prepared and quite happy to do what they're doing. Of course, you will get the exception here and there, and that's okay. That's business.
Okay. Have you ever considered paying the living wage?
The point I'm making now going forward. I beg your pardon?
I'm wondering, have you ever considered paying the living wage of €12.30 an hour?
I don't think the business can afford it. There are certain businesses.
But before all this hit, Pat, your company, the latest accounts for 2018, your company recorded profits of €23.7 million.
Correct.
You weren't paying the living wage then. Could you not afford it then with profits of €23.7 million?
Did you also look and say we paid €27.2 million into the on taxes that year?
Supermax Pat McDonough with Sarah McInerney. Among the many changes, big and small, this pandemic has wrought in our lives has been an increase in people hopping on their bikes to get around, or, in Ray's words,
bikes are the new toilet roll.
Well, testing that theory was Drive Time's Fergal Keane, who went off to a bicycle shop in Swords in Dublin.
Hi, I'm Billy Keaton. I run Richie's Bike Store in Town Centre Mall, Swords, Dublin.
How is business?
Manically busy is the best description for it. Everyone's cycling. Yeah. Everyone's cycling. It's about one of the only things people can do within their 5k limit is walk or cycle. So cycling is taking a major kind of upturn at the moment.
And are people buying these as with a view to permanently taking to the bike, maybe for fear of public transport?
I would say a lot of people who are getting into cycling now would be public transport users in the first place, and after this will not be so keen to get on public transport, so we'll have bicycle.
You're telling me it's quite hard to get bikes. Why is it hard to get them?
Manufacturing in China. Most of bicycles or their parts are manufactured in China, and that's been closed since kind of January. So major backlog across the entire world for bicycles, particularly the kind of entry-level bike range stuff is just non-existent at the moment. Yeah, I could literally sell as many bikes as I could put my hands on, if I could put my hands on.
You can't beat the bike. That was Fergal Keane on Drive Time. Now, remember the volcanic ash cloud from Iceland about 10 years ago? Well, hats off to Kat Gundry-Beck, an Irish woman now living in Reykjavik, for this.
Can you guide me as to how to pronounce it? It was always a bit of a mouthful.
So it's Eyjafjallajökull.
That's exactly what it was. I was about to say it. Tip of my tongue.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. No, it's when you break it down, it's Eyja, which is island, Fjalla, which is mountain, and then Jökull, which is glacier. But if you want to be able to just say it without learning it, you can just say, I forgot my yogurt, really fast.
Oh, that's great.
So, I forgot my yogurt. Eyjafjallajökull.
I forgot my yogurt. Oh, that's great. Okay. That's
now
great.
Now everyone can say it.
Thanks, Kat. Dazzle your friends, everybody. I forgot my yogurt is now the way to say that. Yeah, we couldn't have our anniversary 10 years ago because I forgot my yogurt and the elf. And now we go, gosh, your Icelandic is impeccable.
One more time.
Eyjafjallajökull.
Because every day is a school day. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On the book show, American thriller writer Michael Connelly was Ricochet's guest, and Rick asked him about his latest book.
Talk to me a little bit about Fair Warning, your latest novel. It's the third outing for Jack McAvoy in the lead role. You've had obviously huge success in the past with detectives and with lawyers, And now journalism is getting the spotlight. I mean, that's something you've done yourself for a living. Was it a conscious decision to leave that world in the background for as long as you did?
I write sparingly about Jack McAvoy. Jack is very close to me. He thinks like me. He says the things I would say, but it takes about a year to write a book. And I always face that choice. Who do I want to spend that time with? Someone just like me who says what I would say, does what I would say, or someone different? And to me, that's more interesting, writing about someone different, a detective, a lawyer. I was a journalist for 14 years. I did that for a living. That's how I learned to write. And so it was an important part of my life. And I think journalism, a free media, is a very important part of society. And what I've seen in the last few years is a divisiveness in society about our media. I saw a photo of somebody on a beach who was defying a lockdown order. And she's holding a sign that said, "The media is the virus." And, of course, I've already written Fair Warning by now. But that's really why I wrote Fair Warning, because that's what's going on. And so, you know, I don't really go around making giant political statements in my books. But I wanted to write about this. And what can I do as a thriller writer? And so I just wrote a story about a good journalist. A good journalism story I thought would be, in a way, political. It would be showing what we're in danger of losing if we continue down this path where it's kind of shoot the messenger rather than analyze or look at the message.
Michael Connolly on The Book Show. And in somewhat related news, Twitter, for the very first time, added a fact-checking link to a pronouncement from President Donald Trump about mail-in ballots, a stifling of free speech, wailed Trump, and he even threatened to regulate social media. But with 80 million followers, how can Twitter bite or even nibble at the hand that feeds it? Former head of news and politics at Twitter, Adam Sharp, spoke to Mary Wilson.
How is Donald Trump viewed within Twitter? Is he the goose that lays the golden egg? Is he because he has made Twitter an essential site to visit, to understand him and to keep abreast of what he's thinking?
I think for many in the company, it is probably a complicated answer. You obviously have a company where it's a company made up of individuals who have different political beliefs and so on. While he has certainly demonstrated a value, an informational value of the platform and draws people to it, it's not one that is very easy to, as they say in the industry, monetize. Advertisers are not looking to be associated with those tweets from the president. Mm-hmm. And so for the company, I think they have a challenge that, sure, someone may come onto Twitter to try to see what the president says, but that person doesn't really have a business value to the company unless they start engaging with sport, entertainment, other fields around which there is advertiser interest. So I'm not quite sure I would go as far to say the golden egg, because the golden egg sprouts from these other areas. Okay. But he certainly brings people to the chicken coop.
All right. And he used Twitter, of course, to tell them that he would regulate them.
Oh, you couldn't be up to it. That was Drive Time on Wednesday. On Tuesday, Sarah McInerney spoke to Campbell Spray, former executive editor of the Sunday Independent. It was a conversation prompted by Spray's highlighting of the pressure on people with addiction issues at this time, but turned to the tragic loss of his own son to addiction and the last Christmas they had spent together in Dublin.
In the year, couple of years before that, he had been out of control, really. But in the sort of April before that Christmas, he had a major shock. He had taken drugs with a friend of his, and he had woken up in the morning. His friend was next to him, dead. And that sort of changed Daniel. And he thought, oh, look, you know, I've really got to sort of get myself in order. And he was trying to sort of cut down the drugs, trying to sort of cut out the alcohol. And he was going to come over Christmas. It was a big birthday for me. And I said, OK, you can come over, but there's really strong ground rules. And, you know, there's got to be no drugs. You've got to behave yourself. You've got to be part of everything. And he was brilliant. But our Anon also helped me, fantastically sort of gave me support, say, this is how you put procedures in place. This is how you protect the rest of the family. And he came over and he was brilliant company. He was especially good with my wife's mother, who was just started on the lonely road to dementia. And he would listen again and again to her stories, the same story again. And I said, Dan, that's great you're doing this. He said, oh, no worry. I've got a lot of druggy friends. They do exactly the same. I'm used to it. And he went off a few days after Christmas. My daughter Rachel had sort of got him a lot of sort of new clothes and things. And I gave him a book on the Camino because we were actually going to do it that year or the next year. But unfortunately, the next time I saw him was in the coffin.
And that call to say that he had overdosed, Campbell, must have been a terrible shock, given you'd had such a wonderful Christmas and he seemed to be in such a good place.
It was a shock, but I suppose that when you're dealing with people who have incredible addiction problems, it's a call you're probably always half expecting. Even though they're on the up, you just never know how they're going to go back to it. And it was, you know, I got the call late on a Thursday night. The police had broken into his flat because nobody would be able to contact him for a couple of days. And there he was, very cold, very dead, on the floor in his boxers.
And how was he now coping?
I'm sure any parent's instinct is to get in and save your child if you can, but you can't. So how do you cope with that?
Yeah, there's the awful thing that you think, should you let him go right down to the bottom? And then, you know, but in a way you can't. You've got to sort of, you know, he was a very bright guy. So you actually sort of tried to get him to engage with different groups, see different doctors, perhaps go on medicine, so not terribly keen on some of the drugs he might have been given. But you just help. And, you know, I'd go over and take him on sort of holidays, or he'd come over here. Now, sometimes when he came over here, he'd be great. Other times, he was totally objectionable. And I remember at the time of when the head shops were around, you know, he would just sort of disappear off to the head shops and things. But then that would happen. Then he'd go back and his job would still be there and he'd be doing great stuff and he'd be explaining what he was doing in his job. He was able to sort of live. It was this incredible sort of functioning sort of alcoholic addict thing that does happen. Mm. And I remember after his death, I saw his GP and his GP just said, you'd be amazed how many people in this practice are very, very high-functioning people in the legal, medical world, but are taking strong drugs.
And how are you now, Campbell?
Thank you. Well, look, I'm sitting at my desk, I'm looking at his picture, and it's, yeah, you think what might have been.
Campbell Spray with Sarah McInerney. Singer Tori Amos spoke to Ray Darcy on Wednesday, and Amos recalled recording an album in Wicklow back in the 90s, the impact of the Me Too movement, and the death of her own mother last year. She had suffered a severe stroke, leaving her unable to speak and needing complete care. And Tori Amos spoke about the grief process.
When she died, I thought I'd be relieved, but really then I could remember this incredible human being, that my favorite person really in the world. I was able aloud to remember my best friend, which was my mom. And I kind of went into a real place of grieving. And so it took me a while. You know, I don't think we know how grief is going to affect us, whether it's personal grief, like somebody you love and lose, or collective trauma, like we're going through now in this cataclysm that we're all living through.
Mm. She was a very wise woman. And you imagine conversations with her.
Yes. Yeah.
Describe how that happens, because are you sitting somewhere on your own and then she appears, or what way does it work?
Well, you know, it doesn't happen as often as I'd like, but in the book, there's a conjuring that's going on and evoking of her looking in on me grieving and really not being there for my daughter, and her kind of shaking me awake in the book, talking me through it. So she's always was the strong one and the clear one. And she's talking about, I'm so sorry that this stroke traumatized you so much, Tori Ellen, but now can't you let me have this one? I'm the one that's dead, not you. Yeah. You have a daughter in the other room. Now go. You know how to give love, so stop wallowing. And it was that moment, Ray, I think, that really kind of finally I was able to then dance with the amazingness of Mary, who was mom, and kind of call on her every day. I have chats with her now. It's different now that it's been a year. I'm not in the deep, deep darkness of it like I was soon after.
And Tori Amos went on to talk about performing cover versions, and this particular version of the very beautiful Tom Waits song, Time.
And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time that you love. And it's time, time, time.
You've done a lot of cover versions over the years, and you talk about getting permission from the songs to change them.
Yes, right. Absolutely, yeah.
Right, so how does that work? Well, you sit down to the piano and you start singing it, and then the song sort of goes, no, sorry, Tori, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to let you do that.
If you really ask, show me your secrets.
Right.
They will. If you know what you're doing and you can understand their structure and you can figure out their chordal information and their susses and what they're doing, and then you say, okay, would you like to hold a different dress, a different style, or a different outfit? And they usually say, try it. Let's try it. And sometimes I try it and I might go, you know what? I'm not the person. I'm not the artist to do justice to you. So thank you for showing me your secrets. And I think maybe you should go find Björk.
Always, always Björk. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now to the Book of Ecclesiastes as interpreted by John McKenna on Sunday Miscellany. And yes, to everything there is a season. But in this case, there's also a pet terrapin.
To everything there is a season and a time to every tortoise under heaven. A time to get up in the morning because it's good to stick to a routine, and a time to turn off Netflix at night. A time to plant the 7 packets of seeds you bought online, and a time to dig out the beetroot that has grown all winter and will never be cooked or eaten. A time to kill the neighbours 2 doors down who play heavy metal in the garden late into the evening, and a time to try to heal that rift with the neighbour who jumped the queue at the car wash when such things mattered. A time to break down the wall of the kids' bedroom and get them out into the air. And a time to build up some brownie points with the in-laws. A time to mourn the fact that there won't be a football kicked in anger all summer and Dublin will thus remain unbeaten. And a time to dance to the sound of the killer's human because it seems to catch the state of the race. A time to cast away stones that harbour slugs in the raised bed. And a time to gather stones together for flinging at the neighbours 2 doors down who are still playing that bloody heavy metal.
John McKenna as heard on Sunday Miscellany. On Wednesday's Liveline, Joe Duffy interviewed former Minister of State, TD and Senator Ivor Callaghan. He had suffered a horrific accident on his bike in Cork last year.
Joe, when I came through, I knew there was something seriously wrong because I couldn't move. I couldn't move my face. My face was stuck to the ground and I couldn't move it. I knew none of my limbs were moving. And I had this most frightening experience of my head was spinning around like a football. And it was totally disconnected from my body, which was an appalling, upsetting sensation. And I have to say, it was probably the most fearful time in my life.
Yeah.
And of course, like most of us, when we're in that situation, Joe, we just go into survival mode.
Yeah.
And that's what I had to do. I was lying there about 40 minutes, Joe. I was lying on the road and I was delighted to hear a car coming.
Okay.
And I heard the car coming and I heard it braking.
Mm.
And the next thing I heard it putting it going into reverse and reversing away. And I just couldn't believe it. Now, I couldn't see the car and yeah. I couldn't see anything. So I didn't know where I was and I didn't know what was around me. Joe, it was just so frightening. Everything went through my head. My life went through my head. What lay ahead of me went through my head. Was I going to die on the side of the road? Mm-hmm. I was all alone. It was a particularly poignant time with flashbacks of life, I suppose, and a great sense of sadness and fearful of the unknown.
Yeah.
But about 20 minutes later, I heard footsteps, and this man, I think he was very, very frightened himself because he saw, I presume, a lifeless body on the side of the road with a lot of blood because my face was in a mess. He just came up and all I can remember him doing was saying something like, "Hello, are you in trouble?" Mm. And it was just such a pleasure to hear that man.
He was taken first to Cork University Hospital by ambulance and then to the Mater in Dublin, where he was told he had a double rupture of his spinal cord and he underwent surgery. He then spent months in recovery at the National Rehabilitation Hospital.
How are you today, Ivor? What can you walk? Can you? What can you do and what can you not do? Can I ask, be blunt if I can?
Yeah, look, Joe, first and foremost, I do have residual difficulties. Oh. They say a spinal injury is one of the most debilitating injuries anyone can ever suffer because really, you know, your freedom is snatched away from you. And simple things that you take for granted, you just can't do it. I can't jump in a car. Joe, you know, I was a keen cyclist. Absolutely. I was a keen jogger.
Yeah, and a keen gym.
I can't.
Gym bunny as well.
Yeah. I can't cycle, Joe. I can't jog. Mm. I walk with the aid of sticks. Now, you know, I'm like most other people who have a disability or who are invalided in some way. I've good days and I've bad days. And there's many people out there like me. You know, we suffer a great level of pain. We're unable to sleep. It affects your cognitive function. You're fatigued. You have a level of anxiety. And of course, you suffer great personal hurt, Joe. But, you know, I try to present myself as best I can. I try to get out and do things. Mm. I can't do what I'd like to do. Joe, I haven't worn a pair of tie-on shoes since the accident. Mm. I can't put on a pair of socks properly. I can't put on my trousers properly. I'm not able to button shirts. But, you know, I'm mobile, Joe.
A truly dreadful experience. But of course, Ivor Callaly is also a politician with a criminal conviction. Mr. Callaly was sentenced to a 5-month-long prison sentence in July 2014 for fraudulently claiming mobile expenses at Leinster House while he was a senator. And Joe Duffy had a line of questioning that he was determined to pursue.
And you said you were lying on the road and your life was flashing before you. Now, you've gone from, and we're not going to talk about your personal life, but you've gone from being a junior minister in the Department of Health that you so rightly praised a few minutes ago to going to prison for expenses. What was prison like?
It was quite horrific, Joe. It was a daunting experience and it was complicated by a host of other issues that any reasonable person will find difficult to believe and indeed wish to experience. So look, I've had my difficulties. I've come through them.
When you were lying on that, on August last year, lying on the ground for nearly an hour waiting for help, and you said your life flashed before you, what was the inventory? What was your feeling? What, on the plus and the minus, did you say to yourself, where did it all go wrong? How did I end up in prison? How did I end up, every time my name is mentioned in the newspaper, it's always prefaced by disgraced former government minister Ivor Callaghan. What was big in your mind at that awful time in your life when you're on that ground?
Well, Joe, first, yeah, you're right. There has been some sensational headlines associated with my name, and it's for obvious reasons that some media outlets will run with stuff like that. It's to get attention, and you know, fellas in public life become adjusted to that. But what I can say to you is, yeah, line on the ground. Everything went through my head, Joe. Every single thing. What can you do? As I said, you get into a survival mode, but everything goes through your head.
Everything, but not quite the answer Joe is looking for. We're back to the ground.
Ivor, when you were lying on the ground and your life was flashing before you, did you say to yourself, where did it all go wrong?
Of course, Joe. Everything jumped in front of me. And I was very sad. I was very lonely. Mm. And if I be honest, I shed a tear because I thought I was just going to die on the side of the road.
When you were shedding the tear, Ivor, obviously the horrific nature of your injuries, it's just unbearable even to think about. But were you shedding a tear because of the prospect of dying, or the prospect that every newspaper headline, if God forbid you did die, and thankfully you didn't, would be disgraced former government minister Ivor Callaghan was killed in a cycling accident yesterday?
Yeah, I think I was so close to that headline. It was a near-death experience. I think I was a fraction away from it. And yes, I shed a tear on where I went wrong in life. I have made mistakes, but I'm a human being, Joe. We all make mistakes, and I've learned from those mistakes. I have a lot of difficulties and problems, and I regret them.
Ivor Callaghan with Joe on Wednesday. Artist Catherine Owens was John Kelly's guest over on Lyric on Sunday night, and she did not like school, not one itty little bit.
School maybe would have been one of those lost moments where my main focus was like, how can I get out?
You're an artist now, though. When you look back at school, were you, as they always say, good at drawing? Were you good at, you know, the little assignments you would have been set by the teacher to, I don't know, draw a thatch cottage or whatever the case might be?
Well, it's funny, John, I was absolutely, totally useless at school. For any child out there listening right now who's bad at school, please take heart. There is a fantastic future if you just focus on something you love. But I really did not have a good experience at school. I was educated by nuns. I probably would have done very well in a school that was geared towards the arts, geared towards creativity. We didn't have those options at that time. But I do know that whenever I would come in the door, all of that was gone. My father was a very good artist. He was in the advertising business, but his natural bent was drawing and painting. Mm-hmm. So my style would have been entirely inherited. You know, we used to look at how close our drawing styles were. And when you came in the door, just whatever you were doing was wonderful. Absolutely did not matter, you know, the grades, the this, the that. So there was a little bit of, I guess, fantasy world.
And while there might have been a little bit of the fantasy world, Owens made it to Art College in Belfast based on that focus and determination.
I do remember thinking to myself, okay, I'm really good at drawing and I'm very creative and I'm just going to become really good at that.
Right.
I just do remember thinking, this is it. This is your road out, your open door. And then all the encouragement I would have got at home. So that was one thing. And then the other decision was, it was very clear to me at Art College that I absolutely loved, you know, painting, drawing, sculpture, filmmaking, printmaking, anything where you used your imagination. And I do remember somebody saying to me, oh, well, you know, you can't really be a full-time artist, you know. Kind of no such thing, really.
Interesting. Now we'll pause it just there, because out of the mouth of John Kelly came this icy cold bucket of water. Artsy kids everywhere, cover your ears.
It's okay saying I'm very good at filmmaking, sculpture, painting and drawing. And you're going, yeah, great, but how are you going to make a living at it? It's a reasonable question to ask.
Yes, it is, but for me it was all about the math.
Mm.
I could do the equation. I was able to see
Belfast had a degree, Dublin didn't. New York was where the art world was, Dublin wasn't. I was able to really sort of do a math on that.
And were you confident enough that you could jump from one place to the next, that you would make that journey? Because New York, I mean, I don't know what it was like for you, but for me, New York seemed a very, very, very long way away.
So when I moved to New York, I'd gone there sort of for a year testing things out, and then I really locked into it sort of early 86 time. And I do remember in my bag there was a little letter from my mother, and sort of getting to the other side and reading it, and there was this note saying, you know, if you ever feel like you need anything, you know, we're only a plane ride away and it's only 5 hours. And I remember looking at that and thinking, oh yeah, okay, that's cool. Like, that's that bit taken care of. If it all goes to hell, you know, you can be collected. And there was many, many times over those years where that sort of feeling would, you could go forward knowing that there was always somewhere else you could go to if it didn't work out.
But work out it did, and how. And Owens ended up working with old pals U2 on the likes of the Zoo TV tour and more. So what's the process like? And when you're in the room, who really gets to call the shots?
At the end of the day, they're trusting that you're going to bring new, fresh, good. And then you're all bringing things together into a rehearsal environment for maybe 5 weeks. Yeah. And then they're testing out all the different departments at the same time in rehearsals. And then you're jettisoning things, and then you're re-editing things, or you may be newly commissioning things.
Now, I'd imagine if you were working for, say, the Rolling Stones in that regard, Mick would be all over it. Charlie couldn't care less what you do. You know, that kind of thing. There'd be different dynamics from different members of the band. And I'm just guessing in terms of the Stones. But I'd say you two, they'd all be on it in terms of what they're going to look like at the end of the day.
Yeah, they're all on it.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. They're all on it. And depending on who, you know, obviously I have a strong relationship with Adam, and then I have a very strong creative relationship with Bono. So a lot of my conversations would need to go directly to Edge or Larry. But at the same time, Edge and Larry would come in at a certain point. You know, they'd have their other departments that they were working with, and then they'd come in, and then group decisions would be made.
And then Larry would say yes or no.
Larry, I always say it's between Bono and Larry for me, because Larry has saved many a moment where he'd be like, no.
Quite right too.
Artist Catherine Owens with John Kelly on Sunday. Over on Bjorregan, je sahan shakacha, vishi de conch air on grac.
Chomaila sin sílim gur luatú rud an spéisiún an sin snéad an chraic. Agus sílim in amantí in éirin mar gwyn mwyd chó... Tókul. Chó tókul eis a graac. Agus in amantí braham gwyn mwyd sais imahe dahi ar an graac seo, right? Agus an sin nŵr a chasan tú le cara nŵr nach mín tú dagmwyl lo ach ar WhatsApp.
Yeah.
Cael tú an graac.
Anti-craac carwyn.
It's like any news, no news.
Right. Agus carwyn sílim sin bwta sa hiel sa chlaigin.
Bjor Egan J. Saren Chakacha. Well, that's it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening, and we can only end on this. For anyone who has ever been to an Irish wedding. And now here's a dance you should go. Hey, baby, when the lights are down. Go, hey, grab your baby then. Go, hey, and do the huckabuck. Hey, do the huckabuck. Hey, if you don't know how to do it, then you're out of luck. Hey, shove your baby in.
like a duck.